Good afternoon. It's time for Animal Voices. You're listening to CFRO 102.7 FM. That's Vancouver's co-op radio. We have a couple of interviews today that are going to be fascinating. One with Dr. Jonathan Balcom, who's an animal behaviorist, and he wrote a book called Pleasurable Kingdom. And after that, we are having an interview with Dr. William Tuttle, who wrote The World Peace Diet. And he talks about the impacts of our food choices upon the entire planet, not just ourselves, but how that boomerangs back on us in regards to the violence and the problems we're having in the world today. Before we get to them, I have a few announcements I'd like to make. One is this weekend, the 22nd to the 25th, there is a video fest, the Vancouver International Digital Festival. It's a nonprofit event, and it is for the top creative minds working in digital media. It features galas, creative exchange, intensive workshops, and evening screenings. There's also a lot of speakers there. It is at the Vancouver International Film Center, which is at 1181 Seymour Street. There's screening tickets, which are $10. They're available at the venue. You can purchase festival passes for the whole duration of the festival, and you can register for workshops. If you want more information, go to www.vidfest.com. That's V-I-D-F-E-S-T, www.vidfest.com. Another event that is coming up is the International, well, I shouldn't say international. It's a Vancouver. We have Taste of Health goes on in a variety of cities. So ours here in Vancouver is coming up next weekend. That's the 29th and 30th of September. Both days, all day long. It's going on at the Croatian Cultural Center at 3250 Commercial Drive. And EarthSave is putting on this event. This event also has a lot of speakers, workshops, book fairs, cooking demonstrations, a lot of vendors. It's a fun event. There's lots to learn. The admission is $7. If you're an EarthSave member, you get in free. There's some coupons out there where you can get a discount off the admission. And later on in the show, we're going to be giving away some tickets to EarthSave. So stay tuned for that. If you want more information about it, go to www.earthsave.ca. Now, also, there is the International Japan Dolphin Day, which is coming up Tuesday, September 25th. This is a protest against the annual massacre of over 20,000 dolphins and small whales in coastal towns in Japan, also known as Dolphin Drive. So please assist if you're at work and you're on your lunch hour. If you can get out and do this this walk, that would be great to support it. What's going to happen is that the people will gather outside Granville Sky train station on Granville Street, which is at Georgia and Granville. It's near Georgia. It's just down the road between Georgia and Dunsmuir. They're going to meet at 11:45 a.m. and at noon, you'll all start walking towards the art gallery, and from there go to Burrard and then towards West Hastings to the Japanese consulate. And there they'll stay up to about 2 p.m. So they will provide placards, megaphones, flyers. They really need some support, so please go out there if you can. And you can get some more information about that. Where's the email here? Yeah, she didn't give me an email. All right. Well, call in and we'll try to get an email for you. Anyways, you can Google "no whales in captivity" and we'll see. Maybe you can find them that way. All right. They're also going to be at the Taste of Health show, and they'll have a table there. It's "No Whales in Captivity," C-A-T-C-A, CATCA, and the Canadian Marine Environment Protection Society. So they need some volunteers for help with that. If you'd like to participate, please contact Erica Sabalas Again, she doesn't seem that she's left me a phone number. So please Google No Whales in Captivity and you'll find her. Again, Erica Sedalis. All right. My next interview, we got Carl Loskin is in the studio too, but he's taking a nice rest and he's saying, I think I'll just let you handle the show. My name's Allard. Anyways, Carl may throw his 2 cents worth in here from time to time, but in the meantime, we'll just carry on. My next guest is Dr. Jonathan Balcom. He is going to be at the Taste of Health show coming up. And so he's about traveling the world right now. And so I managed to do a pre-recorded interview for him so that you could get a taste of what his work is like. If you decide to come out to the Taste of Health Festival, he'll be there. So let me just go ahead and start this interview. We're here today with Jonathan Balcom. He's written many scientific papers and lay articles on animal behavior, humane education, and animal research. In 2000, the Humane Society Press released his book, The Use of Animals in Higher Education, Problems, Alternatives, and Recommendations. His second book, Pleasurable Kingdom, Animals and the Nature of Feeling Good, was released in May 2006. He's a popular speaker around the world, and I can attest to this. I heard him speak in Portland in May. And he's currently senior research scientist with the physician Committee for Responsible Medicine in Washington, D.C. Now, the book that he's written, Pleasurable Kingdom, is a book that focuses on the evidence that animals, like humans, enjoy themselves. It debunks the popular perception that life for most is a continuous grim struggle for survival. And instead, it suggests that creatures from birds to bats to baboons may feel good thanks to play, sex, touch, food, anticipation, comfort, aesthetics, and more. So Dr. Jonathan Balcom proposes that evolution favors sensory rewards because they drive living things to stay alive and reproduce. And he explains how our acknowledgement of positive feelings in other animals has important ethical ramifications for our relationship to them. So welcome, Jonathan.
Thanks for having me on the show, Allard.
All right. Could you tell us a little bit about PCRM, first of all?
Sure. PCRM, Physicians Committee for Responsible Medicine, was founded in 1985 by Neil Barnard, a medical doctor here in Washington, D.C., and his original idea was for it to be a think tank to sort of make recommendations and advise on policy regarding preventive health through vegan nutrition. Plant-based diets are a big part of what we do, and also to encourage the use of alternatives to animals in research, testing, and education. But the ideas took off so well that people wanted to join, and it quickly became a member organization. So today we have a staff of probably close to 70 and a membership of about 110,000.
That's impressive. And with regards to the animal research, what have you found are viable alternatives?
Well, there's a whole lot of other ways to do science. You know, animal testing and the old sort of vivisection paradigm, unfortunately, still commonly done, but it's really a World War I, World War II era kind of idea, and it's really past time that we moved beyond that. The main types of alternatives that we continue to encourage to replace animal use include things like clinical testing, in other words, using human patients with coarse consent and doing it in a way that's not harmful to them. There's many, many ways of doing that. Tissue cultures and cell cultures are a very powerful tool. Computers are very good modelers and predictors of phenomena. And so in silico is a technical term there that we encourage to be used. Also, things like epidemiology. The reason we know that high meat, low fiber diet tends to cause heart disease and stroke and cancer is not because of dog or mouse studies. It's because of long-term epidemiological data collected from large populations of human beings. So that's another area. Finally, autopsies is something that we recommend be done. These used to be done regularly. We learn a lot from opening up patients who've died of various causes. We learn a lot about the causes of death and how we can prevent them.
That's great. Now, your book, Pleasurable Kingdom, I'm looking at the cover of it, and if anybody hasn't seen it, it's got two pigs, headshots, and they're nuzzling each other cheek to cheek, and it's about the most loving photograph I think I've ever seen. Did you take that photograph?
I wish I could take credit for that photograph, but apparently it was taken back in the 60s or 70s. I met a professional photographer who was he said when he was a kid about 30 years ago, his parents got him that very same poster at a county fair. So it's been around for a long time, and I don't know much about the origins. But if you look at the photo, you can see that the ears of the two shotes or piglets have been notched, which is to say that they were definitely used in pig farming, because the ear notching is standard practice to identify piglets to their moms, to their sows. And that's kind of poignant, really, because although my book is primarily about pleasure, the work that I do is aimed at trying to improve a lot of animals, including, of course, those used in the meat industry.
Well, that's very interesting. Yes, this photograph just exudes love, despite whatever they might have been subjected to in the farm culture. And perhaps it's, I don't know if it's just the ears were not, they were subjected to anything worse than that, but it's a great photograph. So what inspired you?
We can always hope that they were just a couple of lucky ones, and they had been released perhaps to some sanctuary somewhere and enjoying a proper pig life.
Yes. So what inspired you to write this book?
Well, actually, I was bird watching in Virginia about 6 years ago, and I watched an interaction between two crows, fish crows, it involved what's called allopreening, which is when one bird preens another with the bill. But what was striking about the particular interaction, and I've since seen it in a couple of parrots, was that the one bird solicited this. He or she, I couldn't tell, of course they can, offered the nape of the neck with the feathers sort of splayed out, and then the other one sort of responded by sort of probing the bill around in the neck. And they did this several times, and it really, to me, it struck me as very pleasurable for both birds, certainly the recipient, but I would say also the one giving the massage, if you like. And, I stood back from my telescope after watching this when they flew off, and I thought to myself, well, I'm a biologist. I spent 10 years studying biology in universities and poring through countless, scholarly journals and textbooks and the like. What have I ever read about pleasure? And really, I was stunned to realize that I really hadn't read anything. There's been a gaping void in scientific discourse about positive feelings. And we all know how basic they are to our existence. I mean, so many of our decisions are informed by the anticipation of a desire for some sort of reward. Our favorite hobbies, the clothes we like to wear, our choices for entertainment, our careers, our favorite breakfast cereal, this sort of thing. And yet, we have been mute about these types of experiences for all these other creatures that share the planet with us. So that was the moment when I realized a book like this needed to be written. And it's my hope that science and the public at large will start to view animals more as not just pain avoiders, not just the fearful animals you see in nature documentaries a lot of the time, but pleasure seekers like us.
Do you think that, now you mentioned that we've been mute about this, but do you think that really that mute equates to people being not really conscious of the fact that animals feel or that they just haven't talked about it? I mean, certainly people who have pets, whether they be cats or dogs or birds, are quite aware that their animals feel emotions, I would think.
Absolutely. I mean, living with animals, certainly you get the exposure, and you can learn so much from the personal experience. And if you've tickled a cat's chin or rubbed a dog's belly and you felt the cold and the wet nose nudging your hand for more, this sort of thing, it's really hard to come away from those sorts of experiences and not appreciate that animals enjoy things and that they're sensual like we are and they enjoy pleasures. But having said that, we're so adept as a species at categorizing animals. We have our beloved pets or companion animals, and then we have farmed animals, and we have lab animals or animals in research. We have, I was just in New Zealand and Australia, and often in Q&A after my lectures, people would mention pest animals, animals who are categorized as pests simply because of where they are, and often it's that they've been transplanted unwittingly to some other geographic area. So, if we had the view of all animals that we have of cats and dogs, for instance, then a lot of those other animals would be a lot better. But we don't. We categorize them into some of them are pets and some are pests and some are friends and some are dinner. And yet it's completely arbitrary because a pig feels life just as intensely as a dog, and a chicken just as much as a cat. And so you know, that's a big part of why we need to be talking about positive feelings in animals. We have to realize that life for a chicken has richness, that they have good days and bad, good moments and bad, that life is worth living, to use sort of philosophical jargon, that life has intrinsic value, you know, value beyond any kind of utilitarian value we may ascribe to it, that life for that chicken is worth living for her and not according to any measure that we may have.
And it sounds like really people have to get past their own agendas and their own self-centeredness in order to be able to let in that awareness or allow that awareness to come forth. I mean, if they have a diet where they're consuming a lot of meat products, I imagine that would create a disconnect with their ability to be able to have compassion for, say, farm animals or any animals for that matter.
That's right. That's right. If there's a perception that acknowledging something is going to require me to change some basic part of my relationship with animals, i.e. what I eat, for instance, or what I wear, that is a barrier, and that certainly is one of the reasons why I think we have to be having these conversations, and why books on pleasure haven't been written, is because, consciously or not, it makes us more comfortable to continue to use animals the way we have historically. If we don't acknowledge that they have those feelings.
Yes, and now can you give us an example of animal pleasures from your book?
Sure, I mean, I can give you countless examples, and my book is sort of it's a popular science book, so while I've made a lot of effort to not alienate my fellow scientists, and I have included quite a lot of rigorous science in there, albeit conveyed in a very readable way, there are also a lot of stories and anecdotes. Well, let me think. I mean, one I like to give involves hippos. I just watched a video of a hippo on YouTube yesterday, which I have to say, this YouTube is a pretty powerful thing because it gives you snippets, you know, anecdotes. They're anecdotes, but they really, you know, a picture tells a thousand words, and a moving picture perhaps tells you even more. And there was a 10-year-old hippo who washed up on a bank of a river after a flood. 10 years ago as a little baby, and then this family in South Africa adopted the hippo, and the hippo has freedom to go and spend time with the wild herd in the river there, which the hippo does often. Her name's Jessica, but she generally comes back and enjoys her evening massage. She gets a neck rub, and there's a close-up of her receiving her neck rub, and you can see her eyes getting sort of droopy as she sort of drifts off. And so, you know, that's a very new anecdote that I just encountered yesterday. But in my book, I write about hippos coming into these springs in Kenya in the morning after they foraged on land at night. And they get into this water, and when they arrive, they, as if on cue, these fishes of various species come. By the way, this was filmed by a photography couple through this ingenious underwater viewing tank. Anyway, the fish come. On the arrival of the fish, the hippos lay their toes, spread their legs, open their mouths, and the fish proceed to nibble away at sloughing skin and ectoparasites and bits of vegetation from between their toes, etc. So the fish are getting food. That's their evolutionary benefit. And the hippos, for their part, I guess, are benefiting from a spa treatment. But, you know, animals don't study up on evolution. They behave according to their motivations at the time. The hippos, the fact that they cooperate with this suggests that it feels good, and they start to sort of drift off as well. And by the way, this is one of the challenges of discussing things like pleasures and pains. I mean, they're private experiences, and that's another reason why science has been so reluctant to discuss these things. Scientists don't like making assumptions about things, and yet, as I always point out, we totally assume correctly that other humans feel these things, even though, you know, we can say empathically, I feel your pain. That's just an empathic statement. We can't literally feel another's pain or their pleasure, but do we accept that other humans feel these things? Of course we do. Of course they feel those things. So part of my book is an appeal to expand those horizons of empathy. We need to be applying these principles to other animals too. We need to realize that hippos feel pleasure as we do.
Well, that's of course. Now, you write also a lot about rats. Why do you write so much about rats?
Well, for one thing, they're so terribly misunderstood. I mean, we have had a troubled history with the Norway rat in particular. But I lived with several rats while I was writing the book. I adopted some from the local shelter, and they taught me a lot, and they do show up in my book quite a lot. But there's also been a lot of scientific studies on rats, usually not in the rat's best interest. But I do describe at some length a series of studies done which suggest that rats, well, it really demonstrates what I would call mirthfulness in rats. And also there are shared origins of laughter. The parts of our brains that are active when we laugh, well, the homologous parts of rats' brains are also active when they are making these ultrasonic chirps during play behavior and the anticipation of food, other positive types of context in their lives. And they did a study in which they divided a group of rats into two separate groups, and group A would be petted for 2 minutes a day for 5 days, just stroked on the back by a human hand in a little box. And then the group B rats would be flipped on their backs and tickled in the belly. And then after 5 days of each of these two different treatments, the rats were given a few days off, and then one rat at a time would be put at random into the box and the hand introduced, and they timed how long it took for the rat to go to the hand. And lo and behold, the tickled rats ran to the hand on average 4 times as quickly as the petted rats. So all the rats went to the hand, but the tickled rats appeared to be anticipating their reward that much more. So, tickling for them appears to be a really intense reward. And by the way, that tickling on the belly is very much like the way rats, when they play, they often flip each other on the back and they kind of go into the belly like that. And these are young rats. It's play behavior, and it appears to be pleasurable. And by the way, the tickled rats also made, scientists love to measure things, they made on average 7 times as many chirps, as many of these high-pitched ultrasonic chirps, which are linked by the neuroscientists who did the study. They've been linked to the origins of human laughter. So I consider this is pretty compelling evidence of mirth or joyous affect in rats.
How have your colleagues received your work?
By and large, very positively, and this is a positive sign. Science has been for the last 30 years emerging from a pretty lengthy period. Most of the 20th century, science was mired in this sort of idea that we shouldn't even ask questions about animal consciousness or animal feeling. They're inaccessible. It gets back to that private experience idea, this sort of terminal agnosticism. Ridiculous, really, in hindsight, but that's how it was. And in the last 30 years, finally, scientists have been asking questions about animal thinking, animal feeling. There's a journal now called Animal Cognition. There are textbooks, like a new one coming out called Fish Behavior and Cognition. The phrase fish cognition wouldn't have been dreamed of, or you'd been laughed out of the room if you were a scientist and suggested that fish had cognition 30 or more years ago. And now we have textbooks coming out on that. So it's an exciting time. It's a good time. And there's much more discussion about these sorts of things than there used to be, and hopefully that will translate into more ethical treatment of animals by humans.
Yes, and you know, it's interesting. I was just thinking, it's ironic that with animals having been used so much in experimentation, that they would leave emotions or emotive reactions out of the equation in that research.
One of the problems with animal research, the way it's done, which is to say confining animals in small cages and doing things on them that are not very nice, is that, as you imply in your question, it's stressful for them. It's a negative experience. It causes blood pressure to go up. It causes heart rates to rise. It causes the release of very profound amounts of corticosterone, which is a so-called stress hormone, into the bloodstream. Well, we all know that chronic stress is a negative and tends to make us more vulnerable to getting a cold or the flu or cancer or some other worse illnesses. We know that. That's well known, from epidemiological studies. Well, it's one of the major confounds of using a rat to try and model a human, is that not only is it a profoundly different species with a very different biology and a way of dealing with drugs in the body and that sort of thing, well, also, the animal is often stressed, and that's a further confound in trying to make the extrapolation. It's really, really very hard to extrapolate from a rat to a mouse, never mind a rat or a mouse to a human.
Well, that's true, and we have one of our co-hosts on Animal Voices, who often says, and I think it says it all, is that even with these animal experiments, he says, well, a rat can't tell you if it's got a headache, you know, and I thought...
That's right. Another drawback is they don't have a way of unambiguously explaining how they're feeling the way the way we do.
Yeah, as though the only reactions that are worth monitoring are if they have a rash or their hair falls out, or if they start bleeding, or any of these things, you know, something extreme, or something that's physical to notice, that you couldn't notice things like a rash, or they're feeling disoriented, or their eyes are getting blurry, or whatever, something that you can't determine.
Right, and the irony is that as we understand animals more, as we do think about their experiencing world, and we can get insight from the way they behave, such as the study I just described about mirth in rats, then of course we come to realize that they are in all the important ways, that is the capacity to feel things, their sentience, they're akin to us, they're our cousins, and therefore of course then it throws into question the whole paradigm of using them in experiments to begin with, in harmful experiments to begin with.
That was an interview with Dr. Jonathan Balcom that was pre-recorded about 6 weeks ago. Jonathan Balcom will be at the Taste of Health show, which, as I mentioned before, is at next weekend, September 29th and 30th at the Croatian Cultural Center, 3250 Commercial Drive. You can get more information about the show from earthsave.ca, www.earthsave.ca. We have 4 tickets to give away to the Taste of Health, and that, but for some of you who don't know what the Taste of Health show is, it's a veggie food fair, so it's a healthy food and lifestyle festival, and it's a huge event that is going on every year. So we have 4 tickets to give away to the first 4 callers who call 604-684-8494. That's 604-684-8494. Jeez, I just had a little mind. It must be an old deposit leaving. Anyways, our next guest is Dr. Will Tuttle. He wrote The World Peace Diet. He is an acclaimed pianist, composer, educator, and author. He's performed and lectured widely throughout North America and Europe. His doctorate degree was from the University of California, Berkeley, where he focused on educating intuition in adults. And he's taught college courses in creativity, humanities, mythology, religion, and philosophy. He's got a broad background in both Eastern and Western meditation traditions. He's a Dharma master in the Zen tradition. He's devoted to cultural healing and awakening. He's created 7 much-loved CD albums of original piano music, and also his groundbreaking book, as I mentioned, The World Peace Diet. So let's bring him on the program. Are you there, Will? Okay, let's try that again. Are you there, Will? All right. Let's try it again. Will, are you there? All right, well, let me just play a little bit of Will's music while I see what's happened to him. Will, are you there? try it. No. Okay, we're having some technical difficulties. Hopefully I can get Will on the line here right now. Let's give it a go. Will, are you there?
Yes, I am.
Ah, wonderful. Okay. Well, hopefully everybody didn't hear us scrambling. I have a feeling that that some of this, our scrambling, might have come through the air. Welcome to radio and trying to multitask and get through glitches. Anyways, we're ready to go. I've given my introduction of you. Again, just for the listeners who may have just tuned in, Dr. Will Tuttle wrote The World Peace Diet. The music we were just listening to actually was Dr. Will Tuttle's music. It's one of his compositions. I think I had on Lamb Song. Anyways, very beautiful. And the whole CD is called Animal Songs. It's beautiful. It's like that. So Will, what are we going to talk about today? How about telling us the main premise of your book?
Sure. The World Peace Diet. The idea that we are all born into a culture that has an invisible core that we just can't talk about. You know, it's a taboo subject, but the core, nevertheless, is very profound and deeply rooted in our behavior and in our way of looking at the world, and that is that it is a mentality of reducing beings to things and to commodities, and that it has all kinds of ramifications. It's a mentality of exclusiveness, of predation, of privilege and elitism, of oppression, domination, and exploitation. And the reason it's so powerful is that it's we don't really verbalize it, but we act on it every day at our meals, three times a day. Then we're forced into it as children. So it's not something that, in a sense, we should feel guilty about overtly at all, because no one chose, I don't think, of their own free will to go out and drink the milk out of a cow. We would never have that idea if we saw a cow in a field somewhere, that we would try to go get some milk from underneath her or something like that. It's something we were forced into. So once we realize this, I think then we can begin to question these behaviors and even more importantly, I think, the underlying attitudes, and then begin to try to heal ourselves and our culture and come into more harmony and compassion and kindness, and just sort of the opposite of all those other words I said before, like equality and social justice and equality with women, liberation of the feminine dimension, which is so dominated and reduced by animal agriculture as well.
Well, could you explain that a little bit more? How is our treatment of women affected by our treatment of animal agriculture?
That's especially important, I think. One thing that a lot of people don't realize, I think, is that it is the female animals that are most brutally dominated and exploited in the factory farms, and even before factory farms, just in so-called animal agriculture in general. It's the female animals, because they're the ones that actually give birth to the babies, and so the earliest science, I would say, really in the Western world, was the attempt by men to dominate and control the estrous cycles of female animals. It started way back, probably 6,000 to 8,000 years ago, in the attempts to to control the breeding cycles, have more babies, because these animals were wealth, and so the more babies they could have, the more wealth they would have, the more they could control the females. And modern factory farming would be absolutely unthinkable, impossible, without the complete domination of the female estrous cycles in mammals, birds, and now in fish. So that's the underlying behavior, but what comes from that, I think, really is this whole attitude of seeing the female as something to be used. And you can see historically, this is agreed upon by a lot of anthropologists, that the loss of status of women came about around the same time and right after that, as men started herding animals and controlling the females, that animals were reduced, nature was reduced, and especially women were reduced, and began more and more to be seen as objects to produce babies, objects for sexual gratification, instead of being seen as mysterious partners, fascinating, creative, the way animals actually also, we're all reduced. So this underlying attitude, we're born into a culture that has this underlying attitude, and I think it really works against our ability to successfully create equality and sustainability and to really honor the feminine functions. And in fact, I'll just say one more thing. On dairy farms, especially, and on egg production facilities, they're not, they're really just concentration camps that torture animals. But these places are especially brutal to the females because they're really focused on getting the most product, the secretions of these animals, the milk and the eggs. And so the babies are always stolen from the mothers. The mothers are always brutalized and confined and kept alive for longer periods of time just to be used. And I think what that does to us is that it harms our feminine side, which is the side of us that's more gentle and more nurturing, more caring. And because we deal with these females so brutally, we end up dealing with our own feminine nature just as brutally and repress it. And I think that's why we're able as a culture to really live like this. I mean, to live in a society that, that destroys the beauty of the earth and keeps half of the members of the species really in a much lower position. We just eat this every day. It's this idea of we eat it, and so it's unconsciously in our bodies. And until we start to really question all these things at a deep level, I don't think we'll ever be able to really successfully have more equality or more wisdom, because it's the feminine dimension that's been seen for really thousands of years to bring real spiritual wisdom. It's the Sophia, I call it in the book, is the ancient goddess of wisdom in the Greek tradition, and Sophia represents the feminine dimension of our consciousness that is really the seat of wisdom, and that's what we brutalize in the dairy farms and egg operations and pig operations. All the operations is the female. It's especially dominated, but especially these things that don't seem so bad. You know, milk and dairy and eggs don't seem quite so bad, but actually I think in some ways they are just as bad, or in some ways maybe even worse.
Now, when you mention this too, I mean, a lot of this is connected to the ego. You mentioned throughout your book, I get the message that, when we as human beings elevate ourselves, and certainly that's happening with the treatment, the elevated attitude of being above women. But when we elevate ourselves as a species above other species, then, as you mentioned in your book, then this requires a reduction of essential feelings and awareness. And it requires the species who elevates themselves to oppress and exploit those that they find inferior.
Right. That's exactly it. It really couldn't happen any other way, because our natural sense of kindness towards others, that we know this. I mean, if anyone walking down the street saw someone, harming a child or harming a dog even. I mean, you see what this whole thing with Michael Vick recently, and how outraged we get at the gratuitous brutality of sentient vulnerable beings. There's something in us that just recoils and is just does not want to allow that to happen, and much less to do it ourselves. That really, when we elevate ourselves, like you're saying, it's really we elevate ourselves, but we also reduce others, and it's really that reduction of them to mere objects to be used. We say things like, well, they don't have a soul. I mean, it's so interesting. I mentioned in my book how really, for thousands of years after this happened, women were considered not to have a soul, and it was only males that had a soul, and it was white males, really. I mean, slaves, typically from other cultures, weren't seen as having souls, and it was St. Thomas Aquinas actually argued very strongly that women were incapable of having a soul. They couldn't have a soul because they weren't rational. And finally, the men in the church granted women souls, but I think it's really, who's in power that decides who has the soul, and we say that about animals now, they don't have a soul, but the whole idea of reducing them and saying they don't have a soul allows us to maintain our elevated position, and it actually hurts us in the long run. I don't think, the idea somehow is that by oppressing others we benefit, but I think at a deeper level, we harm ourselves even more, and we create the conditions of misery, not only for the beings that we're oppressing, but we create the conditions of misery for ourselves as well.
Yes, and when you mentioned that, you know, the dogfighting, the Michael Vick thing too, you know, it's interesting to note that people who have dogs as pets tend to be, you know, or people who, even if you don't have a pet, you know, you think of dogs as being our friends and part of our family. And so it's interesting that people become outraged when they hear about the dog fighting, and yet they don't seem to get as outraged when they hear about the brutality that's going on in the factory farming.
Right. Well, it's that same thing. That's such an important point. I think at that one point that you just said, if anyone would spend a little time and just meditate deeply on it, we could liberate, I think, our culture enormously. The more people who do that, because that double standard that you're talking about really says it all, you know. And I've actually been, when I was in Korea, I've been to the places in Seoul, Korea, where they sell dogs. They have dogs in little cages, and they buy and sell them for food. And it's shocking, you know, to a Westerner to see that, you know, because we just never think of animals like that as food. And it's shocking to me to think that now in China, as I've heard, there's whole factory farms like we have for pigs that are for dogs, you know, for St. Bernards. They breed them, and they have them in little cages, and they eat them just the way we do for pigs. And they look at us like we're totally hypocritical, you know, to be more concerned about dogs than we would be, say, about pigs or cows, sheep or goats, because they're all mammals and feel just like, you know, we humans do. So our hypocrisy is kind of obvious to others, but not to ourselves.
That's true too. And when we're speaking, it's. I mean, I get that. Really, this all comes back to our ego, because everything seems to stem from that. If we think of ourselves as superior, or we have a reaction to the dog fighting because it's my dog or our dogs that are happening, you know, it's so ego-centered, these attitudes, and that seems to be the source of all of these problems, is the self-centeredness. Would you say that's correct?
Yeah, I think, you know, ultimately that's the spiritual teachings of the world really all agreed that is the source of the problem. My own background is in Zen Buddhism, but I used to teach, you know, comparative religion, and that's a really universal insight, I think, this fundamental sense of being separate, and that somehow I can improve my welfare at the expense of someone else. I can make myself, you know, better off by harming someone else. The spiritual teachings of the world, whatever they are, whatever tradition, the universal principles say, no, it's not how it is. We're all interconnected. The sense of the interconnectedness of the welfare of all of us, I think, is a much deeper teaching, and that is a much more true for us as not only as human beings, but really, I think, for myself, as manifestations of a spiritual presence, that we are, when we start harming others, we harm ourselves. And these teachings are universal. You see them in all the religions, and not only in religions, but just in the folk wisdom, the idea of what goes around comes around, that if I cause misery to others, I'm certainly not going to end up being happy. And we see this in our own life. We don't have to take these teachings, you know, as outside. We see this from our own, you know, inner wisdom. We can see this, that as we encourage others, help others, and so forth, we feel better. We feel better about ourselves. As we confine others in some ways, control them, dominate them, we end up being more and more miserable ourselves. And so we, as a culture, we do this on a massive level to animals, and from my point of view, it becomes obvious once we look deeply into the real roots of our dilemmas as a culture, sort of look behind the curtain of where you're not supposed to look, you know, look behind the curtain of the millions of animals that are brutally mutilated and killed every day for food in this country, North America, then you see that we're doing this to animals, and it does boomerang back to us. It does come back. The more we inflict pain and suffering and sickness and disease and environmental catastrophes on these animals, the more we find we're experiencing in ourselves, and we just seem to get farther and farther away from actually solving problems because we're eating more and more animals.
Now, what about the people who say, you know, look, I can appreciate the factory farming thing, but I am still a meat, dairy, egg eater, and I make sure that I get certified organic eggs, and I make sure that I eat grain-fed, you know, animals, beef or lamb or whatever it is. What would you say to those people with regards to their consciousness or with regards to everything, I guess?
Right. Yeah, that's happening more now. I think it misses the main point. You know, the main point is we're confining and killing animals. We're stealing their purposes from them. We're making their purposes serve our purposes. Whenever we do that, we're sowing the seeds of misery for others, and we will reap that for ourselves inevitably. It's not going to happen any other way. And I think if people look really deeply into their own hearts and lives, it's hard to do, but if we do, then we see that the underlying stress and disease and anxiety and fear and addictions that we have are things that really come from the basic truth that we're not comfortable with ourselves. We're really not comfortable as a culture with ourselves, with how we're living on this earth, and that's what allows us, I think, to devastate the earth so totally like we're doing, and to really treat each other as commodities, as enemies that we kill, as people that, you know, that we would use or try to take advantage of. So as long as we're doing eating that, whether, you know, we can say it's organic, but for the animals themselves, they are being their lives are not being respected. You know, they're whatever the situation is, it's analogous, I believe, to slavery. You know, really, in many ways, if you want to, you know, whether you whip the slave, beat them, or whether you're nice to them, you're still basically treating them as an object that you own, and that always brings out the worst in people. And I've been myself to these organic dairies, and I've looked behind the curtain, and I've seen brutality against these animals. It does happen.
Mm-hmm. And now, for people who are still, like I say, on a meat diet, you know, I'm just thinking in terms of how they might respond to this too. And one question they might throw at you is, well, you know, there are certainly a lot of other carnivorous creatures out there who are eating other animals. That's just the design of things. We certainly wouldn't want to project upon them that, like, for example, our dogs, that they're not compassionate creatures because they eat animals, because we know dogs can be quite loving. So what about that?
Well, that's a good one. You know, there's lots of different rationalizations people have, and you know, that I like that one in a way. I mean, it's kind of cute. You know, it's like, well, you know, these animals, I mean, they're eating meat. You know, they're eating other animals. They're jumping on them and killing them. So we should do that too. Or it doesn't mean we're not loving if we do it. And I think it's just very selective. I mean, you could find, if we look into the animal realm of other beings, you know, that we call animals, and we can see all kinds of behaviors that they engage in. And if someone did them, we would be shocked. You know, I mean, if someone, there's quite a few species where the males of the species, when the babies are born, if they can get to them, they'll kill them and eat them. You know, and if some human being killed and ate his little babies and said, well, you know, animals do that. I think I'd like to do that too. Or, you know, there's lots of examples. I mean, the coyotes love to regurgitate their food for each other. You know, if I took my wife out on a date and then regurgitated some food onto her plate, that doesn't mean she'd think that was romantic. You know, these are things that animals do. You can find any number of behaviors that animals engage in, and it would be absurd to use that as a rationalization for us as humans to do the same thing. And I don't think that in any way it's necessary. I mean, we've been given, if you just look at our physiology, we've been given the gift of bodies that require no animal to suffer in terms of getting nutrients. So there's no reason that we maybe have to eat animal foods in this day and age.
And that's true. And, you know, we only have a few minutes left. So what is the difference between our bodies and a carnivore's bodies? What's the proof for why we should be vegetarian or vegan?
Well, I have a whole chapter on this in my book called The Intelligence of Human Physiology, and it's very fascinating. You can just start, I mean, it would take, you know, it would take me a long time to say all of it, but I'll just say maybe just briefly, you know, from the beginning, if you look at our dentition, just the teeth that we have, the facial structure that we have, the hardness of the teeth, you know, our teeth are, don't have the hardeners that most that all carnivorous animals do. We have very soft teeth. We have very small teeth. We have a very flat face. We have the dominant the primary enzyme in our mouth is ptyalin, which is strictly for dissolving carbohydrates. There's absolutely no carbohydrates in any animal foods. We don't have any taste receptors for protein like carnivorous animals do. We have it's just for sweet and salty and so forth. So there's nothing in our mouths. I mean, and to actually actually imagine biting into the flesh of a living animal is disgusting, or you know, or into a live fish or something. You know, it would just no one would do it. I mean, really, it's on that level and going all the way down. I mean, we don't have the strong stomach acids. We have a circulatory system that is absolutely botched up. I mean, it guarantees the profits of the medical system to have people eating a lot of meat because it just clogs up our arteries and veins in ways that it wouldn't do for a natural carnivorous being. And so there's a whole endless list of our we have a long digestive tract that forces all this meat and dairy products to rot and cause constipation and diverticulosis and lots of other diseases. And we don't have renin, so we can't digest casein, and that causes arthritis and all kinds of problems. We have endless, I mean, according to a lot of the research, between 80-90% of doctor's office visits are strictly due to dairy and meat. And so, you know, this is great for the medical pharmaceutical establishment, but for us as humans, if we want to be healthy, the last thing we need is animal foods.
That's true. Well, our show has come to an end. It's been a great pleasure to have you on the show, Will. Thank you for coming on. And as you've been listening to CFRO 102.7 FM, that's Vancouver's Co-op Radio. My name is Allard. I've been interviewing Dr. Will Tuttle, who wrote The World Peace Diet. And as we leave today, I'm going to play one of Will Tuttle's compositions from his CD, Animal Song. And it is a chicken song. Here we go. Thank you all for listening. Please come back next week.